Now, I don't listen to music softly. I'm one of those people who turns it all the way up until I can feel it in my gut. And Abby Dose had ear mites when we got him. Took him right away to the vet and had them removed, but it damaged his hearing. And tonight, as I was playing music before the program, Abby Dose just went berserk. It was like, holy mackerel, I can hear that. I can hear something. And he was trying to get up to the speaker. It was really something. He really, really liked the music. And it's because it was so loud. Either he could feel it or he could actually hear it. I think his hearing has been, like somewhat damaged. And he just wanted to be on the speaker. It was like, hey, I can hear. It was really cute. I'm running a risk. They're both in here. Dusty and Abby Dose are both in here tonight. We'll see how it goes. Of course, ABC World News tonight co-anchor Bob Woodruff and his cameraman were seriously injured Sunday when the Iraqi Army vehicle they were traveling in encountered one of these damn improvised explosive devices. And my understanding at this hour is that it looks like they're going to live. Their injuries are apparently not life-threatening, thank God. But many others have died. Subject for another show. Depend on it. Dr. Nick Begich and HARP, they go together. Dr. Nick Begich is the eldest son of the late United States Congressman from Alaska, Nick Begich Sr., and political activist Peggy Begich. He is well known, very well known in Alaska for his own political activities. He was twice elected president of both the Alaska Federation of Teachers and the Anchorage Council of Education. Heavy stuff. He's been pursuing independent research in the sciences and politics for his entire adult life. Begich received his doctorate in traditional medicine from the Open International University for Complementary Medicines in November of 1994. Dr. Begich is editor of Earth Pulse Flashpoints, a new science book series. Begich has served as an expert witness and a speaker before the European Parliament. He has spoken on various issues for groups representing citizen concerns, statesmen, and elected officials, scientists, and others. Tonight, we're going to talk about climate change, gas and oil issues, but we're going to get an update on HARP. Now, we had a program scheduled tonight originally with Get Off My Keyboard, You Little Monster. See, the problem is they open programs and sometimes run them. Sometimes they get up there and the toes tap correctly and they take one of my programs and put it in the trash bin. They have not as yet ejected it from the trash bin entirely, but it's been close. Anyway, where was I? The program we had scheduled, Dr. Begich and Bernard Eastland, and Bernard Eastland canceled, had to cancel for one reason or another. Now it is being rescheduled, and that's going to be a hell of a program because Eastland is the brains, pretty much, behind HARP, the ever suspicious, mysterious HARP project in Alaska. And so we'll get an update on HARP. I have my own suspicions about what it's doing to our shortwave bands, which I will not keep to myself. And we will discuss HARP and then, of course, the weather and climate control and that sort of thing in a moment. Well, all right, here we go. What a pleasure, all the way to the state of Alaska, which, by the way, will certainly serve well as a discussion point for the climate and the changes we're experiencing when we get to that. That's where Nick Begich is, of course, in Alaska. Welcome back to the program, Doctor.
Hey, it's good to be back with you again, and it's just good to be back on the air talking about these subjects. A lot of has happened, over the decade that we've been talking about these issues. So it's always good to get people up to speed on what's new and what's the latest on some of this technology.
Right. We don't have a lot of time,
Right.
so we're going to knock down a lot of subjects here. Number one is HARP, of course. Now, we had a program scheduled with yourself
Right.
And Dr. Eastland.
Right.
And that would have been one mama of a show. Now, I understand it's being rescheduled. Do you know anything about that that I don't?
Yeah, it is being rescheduled. In fact, and I'm going to have an opportunity to have dinner with Dr. Eastland next month in February when I'm in his part of the country. So we'll get a little bit of a chance to kind of get him up to speed on what we've been covering, and hopefully we can get him in on the schedule, because I think that's going to be, from my perspective at least, probably the most important program you and I have ever done on the subject.
I quite agree with you. Please tell the audience, just in, 30 words or less, what HAARP is, HAARP. What we're talking about. HAARP.
Sure.
HAARP.
It's a project currently run by DARPA, and it's a field of antennas, radio frequency antennas, that essentially focus radio frequency energy in a unique way that can be manipulated for a number of weapons applications. And, you know, some of those include things like weather modification, which is, you know, sort of the narrow subject of the night tonight.
And, yes.
You know, but this whole concept of weather modification is something that, since the very beginning of the HAARP program, has been looked at again. I know something that Dr. Eason will, I'm sure, talk about when we're on together, but he had actually done work for the European Space Agency after the HAARP project was underway with ideas about utilizing the HAARP system or systems like it for knocking out, for instance, the energy of tornadoes.
Yes.
And then, you know, from there was work done by Eastland again for NASA and for FEMA looking at space-based systems, using space-based lasers for accomplishing the same kind of activity in terms of tornado mitigation.
Is it fair to call Dr. Eastland one of the main brains behind a HAARP?
Yeah, absolutely. He,
good.
He hired the original team, put together the team that became later ARCO Power Technologies, Inc. He was actually running all of that, put together the original patents, you know, all of the critical patents with HAARP. And, you know, and some of the things in the patents, which is, again, something that we'll get into when we get him on the air with us, but this whole issue of weather modification and the ways you might approach it in a little different approach than what he had originally conceived of. And then at the same time, one of the big aspects of those patents that's never been explored is the use of this type of technology, for instance, for replenishing ozone.
Which I wonder how much of what he originally conceived, Doctor, really is the main focus of what's propelling HAARP
right
now.
Right. It's much different now, and I would definitely agree with that. And you know, and he's been out of the project now, you know, a number of years, enough years so that his original agreements with ARCO, which had 15-year secrecy provisions, are now expired. And that's where you get a lot more interesting conversation.
What percentage of what he tells us do you think, maybe that's the wrong way to ask it, how much do you think there would be that Dr. Eastland knows that he could not open his mouth about?
Oh, well, I'm sure there are some areas that he can't get into. I mean, certainly. And he's done work, you know, going back to the Atomic Energy Commission in the 50s. So there's lots of projects that he can't talk about. And, you know, and that's, you know, just part of it. But there's, you know, there's a change that says, you know, in my view, you know, and I've gotten to know Dr. Eastland over the last, you know, decade, you know, fairly well. And, you know, he's gone through some, you know, changes in terms of how he views his science. And quite frankly, at this stage in his life, you know, including the weather modification issues, he knows that if these issues are going to be pursued in a safe and responsible way, if pursued at all, it can't be done in the darkness of military planners.
Yes,
it has to be done in a much more open...
What do you think he'd say if I said, Dr. Eastland, is HAARP potentially screwing up shortwave right now? Is it screwing up the ionosphere? Is there a chance it's HAARP doing it? What do you think he'd say? Do you think he'd admit the possibility?
I think he would. I think there's a lot that he will, you know, and in my conversations with him, clearly there's been a lot of things that he's pointed out as big caution points, and I think the approach that he's taken, even in his more recent papers, is really the suggestion to other scientists to start looking at multidisciplinary approaches to their science, because often things are missed because you just don't have the training. You
know, I remember just before your last appearance, I think it was,
yeah,
there was a story that there had been an aurora going on above the HAARP project.
They poured
like a billion watts or whatever it is into this aurora, And the scientists were able to rush outside the building and look up and see all this sparkly, these various colored sparkles being produced by the power they were hitting the aurora with. And I thought, oh my God.
Right, that's exactly right. They can produce that kind of visual effect by pulse modulating the signal on the ground and
exactly.
Having it interact.
Well, that's toying with Mother Nature.
Absolutely.
There's no other way to put it.
Absolutely. And there's huge risks involved. I mean, when you think about, and again, what's happening with this science is really important because, you know, you have a congressional committee right now in the House and one in the Senate being formulated. There's bills pending to formulate commissions to look at weather modification in terms of commercial and non-commercial applications.
Well, you've spoken extensively with Dr. Eastland. Has he admitted to you directly that there are, in quotes, huge risks?
Not to use those words, but he's indicated to me where the risks are. How about I can say it that way? And as a physicist, how big is a huge risk? You know, it's big when you look at the potential downstream consequences of coupling a machine to the environment.
Yes.
So his cautions to everyone is, look, when you're working in big science, you can't do it in a closet.
Yes.
You have to do it in the open where you get the full benefit because of knowledge, because you can't play games with man. It's not like the old days. Cloud seeding is one thing. We're talking about huge implications.
You can play games. Now, let me push you a little bit and ask you, to the best of your recollection, Doctor, how did he describe these risks?
I think the biggest concerns were triggering whatever runaway effects might be triggered in the upper atmosphere and in the ionosphere when you start to accelerate electrons, which is where the big action is, and as the system gets more powerful, you're literally coupling it to the magnetic field lines of the Earth in certain applications.
Yes,
you're really plugging into the dynamo of the planet. So when you start, it's just a high risk area. Now here's where his newest work has gone, and this is again why I think it needs to be out in the open. And he did a paper that was delivered at Penn State's Lehigh campus, and it was on the artificial generation of acoustic and gravitational waves in the atmosphere for weather modification applications is what this paper is about. And it uses, from what he has learned in these interim years, is that as much as 1,600 times less energy, perhaps, to create weather effects than what he originally anticipated. So when you start to think about it in those terms, then everyone needs to take a deep breath and a pause and say, wait a minute, we're being very careful.
Doctor, how does he know he's not screwing up the weather now?
Well, you know, he's out of that project. I mean,
Okay. How does he know HARP is not screwing up the weather now?
That I couldn't say. You know, I mean, my own personal view is that there are implications to HARP based on what we already know that say, yeah, when they operate it in certain modes of operation, it's having weather effects.
So we're not saying that this and what we're about to discuss is being caused by HARP, but I would like you to describe the changes taking place around you. Now, you're in Alaska.
Right.
And everything I've read in every science journal, every story has suggested that Alaska is in big trouble, disproportionately big trouble compared to the rest of the world right now.
Right.
Is that fair?
That's a fair statement. In fact, we're the canary in the coal mine is literally what we are in Alaska.
So how's the canary doing? What's going on up there?
Well, you know, we've had the warmest temperatures on record, of course, like everybody has, but we have more extremes. You know, they say average temperatures in the ocean to increase one degree supposedly takes 50 years. Well, here in Alaska, in a counter-cyclic to El Nino cycle a few years back, we had 5 to 15 degree temperature increases in our oceans.
Oh, my God.
Substantial. Now, and this is enough to where I fish every year, subsistence fish every year, and when you're in the water, you notice 5 to 15 degrees,
I should say, yes. Are you sure it's that high?
Absolutely. In fact, the articles that ran on the story, it baffled scientists here because it was the opposite cycle of the El Nino cycle. It was back in the latter part of the 90s. And when you look at that situation, then sort of what else has been seen since, you know, we've seen migrations of fish species in our waters that we've never seen before. I mean, even in South Central Alaska and Anchorage, we don't have a deer in this region, or we didn't. They've spotted them two seasons in a row now migrating up from the south, something that's never been seen here.
That's incredible.
You look at the vegetation footprint across the north slope of Alaska. It's increasing over the last 40 years dramatically when you look compare aerial photographs. And what that does, as snow cover is removed and more dark ground cover is revealed, it increases the amount of heat absorbed, which then creates a huge chain reaction in terms of adding to this problem of climate change. And we see it here first.
Well, all right. The glaciers in Alaska, that should certainly illustrate something to us. Over the last, I don't know how many years, how much retreat on average has there been in the glaciers? What's going on with the ice?
Okay, where I'm standing right now, which is just a little bit north of Anchorage, the glaciers 6,000 years ago were 4,000 feet thick where I'm standing. Now, in my lifetime, a place called Portage Glacier, which is not far from where I am, it's about 60 miles from here, the glaciers retreated to the point where as a kid I could see it and the ice would form in the lake, and
right.
and it's gone. It's all the way around the corner. But that glacier's receded almost 9 miles over the last 100 years. And
wow.
You know, the real change though is happening now. I mean, we're seeing huge increases in the last 40 years, decreases in the ice level in the Arctic by 40%. Our glaciers, they say, are contributing more fresh water to the oceans than even Greenland right now, coming out of Alaska, because of the way our glaciers are melting down and the way the currents hit South Central Alaska, which is where most of the glaciers have formed.
What about your tundra?
Well, this is the big change, too. As I said, when you get the heating effect in the northern part of the state, it starts to melt the permafrost under the tundra, which acts as a cap for really the methane gas that then is produced by the decaying material, some of which has been there, you know, 100,000 years.
Yes.
And so this produces methane in large quantities, which actually contributes to the heating, which exacerbates the whole thing. So you get this amplifying effect that sort of feeds on itself in the Arctic, and then, you know, you have these changes in glacial formation. Like some places, it's laying down an awful lot of snow these days, adding to glacial thickness.
Mm-hmm.
Not in Alaska, but the reason for that is these regions that used to be so cold, you couldn't get precipitation, you couldn't get moisture formation from the oceans going up into the sky, forming snow, and then dropping down on glaciers. So now you have this change where some areas are building, other areas are shrinking, but the net effect is global warming. And coastal cities around Alaska, they're small villages or small communities, up to 60 of them are at risk right now because of more extreme storms in the season, rising sea levels.
Doctor, as you go north in Alaska, way north, toward the pole, it's become so bad. I saw a special on Discovery Channel that indicated that polar bears, in increasingly large, disturbing numbers, are beginning to drown because they can't find ice.
Right, and this is the Arctic region. They're actually, if you look at the pole, if you look at where we sit in terms of the Arctic from Europe, in terms of sea routes, they're predicting that's going to be open in the next 10 to 12 years.
Yeah, did you hear that, folks? The sea route over the pole is going to be open in the next 10 to 12 years. The armed services are figuring out how to navigate what's going to be a sea up there. I mean, this is, you know, doctor, we're not supposed to notice things, changes, like this in our lifetimes. I mean, our lifetimes are just whoosh, and we should never see these kind of massive changes in our paltry little lifetimes. It should be millions of years, not decades.
It depends on whose theory you ascribe to, you know, because there's really two theories, and I think there's probably a little of each to be considered.
Well, I subscribe to the facts.
Yeah, and the facts say cataclysmic change does occur from time to time, and it also says a gradual change occurs. Absolutely. But when you combine those two, especially when you look at what's happening around the planet today, significant changes are taking place. And these aren't just in terms of climate. You can see the same kind of patterns in terms of earthquake frequency and intensity. You can see it in tidal heights in the North Sea. I mean, you have a lot of factors.
Doctor, last night I had a guest on in the first hour who talked very extensively about a pole shift, and it appears by the list of questions that I've been supplied here that you feel that perhaps everything that we see going on is leading toward or part of the pole shift process. Is that going out too far?
No, I think that actually sums it up. I mean, I really do think these things are all interconnected. I don't think they're operating in a vacuum, although, you know, we artificially separate the disciplines and the sciences. Nature doesn't, you know. These things all work together. And when you look back at the consequences, I'll give you a good example. If you think about the pole shifts, the interim shifts, not the full reversals.
Yes.
And there's been a number of those. You know, if you go back 80,000 years ago, the magnetic North Pole was about the middle of where the Yukon Territory and the border of Alaska in a place called Whitehorse. If you look 50,000 years ago, it was off the coast of Scandinavia. And if you look 15,000 years ago, which is a really interesting number, yeah, it was right at the bottom of Hudson Bay.
Yeah, now, you know, I've heard that it's been perhaps, you know, there are small shifts all the time,
right,
but there have been some pretty good jump arounds. In fact, I think our pole now is headed for Russia, isn't
right,
it?
Right, at a really fast rate, accelerating beyond what has been like a very sharp, steep curve. And
yes,
this is what seems to be the case. And when you think about 15,000 years ago, that was the beginning of the Ice Age, where ice moved all the way down into the Midwestern United States. And if you put the North Pole and move the globe, you know, look at where that would be if that was the ice sheet, the center of the ice sheet, and compare it to today. And this, and so when you see these shifts, and then 15,000 years ago moving to its current location, and then from there you saw the receding glaciers that happened very rapidly, and in my part of the world extremely rapidly, leaving behind, you know, clear message of when and what occurred. And you know, we're in this same kind of acceleration now when you take a look at climate change, and then you look at what man's contributing, what nature does, and when you talk about heating the engine of the earth, you know, in terms of weather, you also have to factor in what's going on under the seas, which occupy most of the surface of this planet.
Doctor, people have very diverse opinions on this, but if we do experience a sudden pole shift, what is your view of the effect it would have on all of us?
Pretty devastating. I mean, if it were a sudden shift,
yes,
you know, I would expect wind velocities that we've never even heard of, you know, before, and I would expect to see
200 or 300 miles an hour.
Yeah, that kind of, you know, 300 mile an hour winds, I think, would be, you know, expected. You know, what else happens when you lose, you know, when the pole actually makes that shift? Nobody really knows, you know, but every organism, every living organism, has a biomagnetic component that's very important to life on the planet. So what happens on those shifts, I think, is going to be really interesting. I mean, migration patterns that are organized based
on magnetite, I believe, isn't it? Magnetite in brains,
right,
including the human brain?
Right.
Birds use it to navigate, that sort of thing?
Yeah, exactly. So you got navigation issues, and you already see it. You know, where you already have pole shifting, you've got these really bizarre things happening with migration patterns reported anecdotally in the 90s and more frequently now. And
that's,
I think,
right,
you'll see more of that kind of shift because that's how these animals migrate. When you start to look at you know, energy interactions in human health, you know, we're finding out that very little change in energy concentrations, densities, the way in which we interrelate, can have profound effects on our health.
Do you believe that a pole shift would be the end of life down to the cellular level? Would it be that bad?
You know, I don't think so, because we know we've had them every 750,000 years. And so you can look at the geologic record and you can see, you know, changes, but not total starting over. You know?
But a real bad day for the planet.
Yeah, a real bad day for everyone. Yeah. You know, the thing about all of this, too, is this, we don't know when exactly that is, and certainly we're in the frame of time where it can occur, given the geologic record, full reversal. But we absolutely know there's a pole shift taking place at an accelerating rate, and there's no disputing it. The science proves it. The implications of that, you know, everyone wants to argue about. It's like arguing climate change. You know,
yes.
Is it man or is it nature? Well, at this point, it's not relevant, as relevant as the fact that it's changing, and those changes are going to have profound implications for every living thing on the planet.
All right.
So,
well, almost every living thing on the planet, human-wise, knows what happened this last year with hurricanes,
right.
Doctor. Now, I'm afraid I view that as just a warm-up, no pun intended, just a warm-up. And I think that in the next several years, we're going to see a lot worse than we saw. And it was terrifying.
I think I agree absolutely. And you know, we've said it, and you've said it, you know, in the 80s, where the 90s doubled, you know, and dwarfed what happened in the 80s, and this century's already dwarfing the 90s. But the reality is, even if you assume man was fully responsible and we stopped, all the experts say if we stopped everything dealing with fossil fuels and the contribution, it'd take 100 years to stabilize. But when you add in natural releases of energy and increased energy, being displaced on the planet, all of those things combined, there is no reversal at this point. It's only a recognition of the reality of climate change, the reality of Earth changes generally, and the smart issue is to not dispute so much the cause as to say, how do we deal with agricultural changes? How do we deal with what's happening? I mean, here we're seeing it.
I know. Forget the argument. Just forget the whether it's man-made or cyclical. Who cares? It's happening, so we have to react to it if we want to stay alive.
Exactly. And like here in Alaska, the spruce forests, and you remember how they are in south central Alaska. They're beautiful.
Oh, yes.
And we've lost our spruce forests by the overinfestation of spruce bark beetle, which is cyclic again, but with climate warming, they don't die off like they did normally, and so we've lost the spruce. Now the birch in our part of the state are infested with a mite that's killing them off. You know,
this is incredible, folks. I was in Alaska some years ago, and I saw the beginnings of what you're hearing being talked about right now, and you just looked, and there were dead and dying trees all over the place. I mean, it's totally freaky. It's one thing to sit here and talk about it, but to be up there and to see the trees dying and to understand why is just, it's pretty chilling stuff.
And, you know, historically, you know, when we start to look at, you know, climate trends, there's things that we can look towards that, you know, give a lot of good indicators, you know, from tree ring growth to know that certain things are cyclic. But when you look at the compilation of things happening on the planet today, it's like a lot of factors moving together. And then you look at government development of technologies to interface with the environment and actually control environmental effects. You know, maybe there's a lot more known than meets the eye.
Dr. Eastland believes that HAARP absolutely has a use in weather control. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. And you know, and here's the thing about all that, and this is the important thing to remember, is the planet is so complex that figuring it out, you know, we're still figuring it out. Everyone's figuring out how this engine connects to itself. It's, you know, so when you start throwing things into the mix when it's already unstable, that's wherein the danger lies. And again, where, you know, this science is being pursued already by governments, has been for decades. The problem now is that what we've learned and what scientists have discovered can be done with so much less energy.
Yes.
And then you start to see people like William Cohen, when he was commenting on weapons of mass destruction, international terrorism, back in 97 at the University of Georgia, he talked about environmental weapons that terrorists would possess that would manipulate earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, and climate using electromagnetic waves. And he said that at University of Georgia, and he was lecturing with actually Senators Lugar and Nunn at the time.
All right. By way of the HAARP experiment and other stuff, we probably don't know about, Doctor. There's no question about the fact that governments are intensely interested in weather control. Now,
yeah.
You can either take the view that they are, in fact, controlling the weather, or that somebody in a private situation room meeting at the White House said, look, here are the real facts. We're in deep crap. We need to do something. And HAARP at least has the possibility to perhaps control the weather. So do you think that privately, secretly, our government is saying we are in deep stuff here and we need a way to get a handle on it? Let's give more money to the people at HAARP or whatever.
In terms of this type of technology, absolutely yes, because the military and our government and every good government plans for every possible contingency. And when the scientific evidence is mounting, and this administration hasn't always been the most responsive to that scientific evidence, but
publicly.
Yeah, but bureaucracies function apart from the leadership to one level, and that is when you get deep enough in bureaucracies, the research, the programs, and the preparedness, the machine kind of runs on. It's just too big. And as a consequence, you've got a direction has already been set of preparedness because everyone who understands what's happening climate-wise agrees that the changes are here and they're not going away in the short run.
Right.
And so it's not, it's not a time to get all panicky and uptight. It's a time to say, okay, given this, and we know it's happened historically, let's get our best minds together to say, first of all,
what can we do?
What can we do that makes sense? And then secondly, if there's technological applications that can be applied, let's see if there's a way to do that.
Let me ask you about one of those, if I might, please. When we're talking about weather modification, that's what we're doing, in what way can you imagine, or can Dr. Eastland imagine, that HAARP could, in fact, control the weather? Technically, how would it be done? Would there be something dispersed in the atmosphere and then enormous energy reflected on this substance, or what do they imagine?
No, it would be, you'd be able to modulate gravitational waves in a way, or perhaps modulate in heat the ionosphere in such a way as to divert or control the flow of jet streams, and from there control then where weather goes and how it flows. And that's the name of the game. I mean, if you can control jet streams, and then there's the moisture flows that are in different parts of the upper atmosphere. If you can control those factors, then you've got it made.
What if you can control the temperature of the ocean? Now, we all know hurricanes. Yeah. We were all instructed endlessly on CNN and elsewhere how hurricanes form and what feeds them.
Right.
When they go across hot water, what happens? When they go across cold water, what happens? Could HAARP affect the temperature of let's say the water ahead of a big storm?
That's part of the work that Ben has been doing in terms of knocking out the intensity of tornadoes, as an example, because that's the same kind of situation, except it's a warm front hitting a cold front, and you get that shearing tornado spin. By heating up the cold front, the idea is that you don't have that temperature differential that creates those. In terms of the heating of the oceans, the amount of energy involved in discussing that specifically with Dr. Eastland, that's probably not in the picture at this point, at least not with HAARP as it's currently configured. But, when you think about using systems that can resonate with water to create heat and release of energy sufficiently to increase the strength of a hurricane, the Russians have claimed that technology going back years.
It's
been reported in the New York Times and other publications. So we know there's technology out there that can accomplish that.
And that's what they've said publicly.
Yeah. Now, here's the other thing that is not being considered that I think needs to be considered when you talk about temperature increases, whether it be in the Caribbean or in the Pacific, is undersea volcanoes. And there are volcanoes within the Caribbean. In fact, there's one, I think, smoldering down there now and in Central America. When one of those, here's sunlight, it strikes the surface of the ocean, most of the heat is dissipated and reflected, and only a very small amount is absorbed into the sea, and it stays at the surface.
Right.
Because it gets colder the deeper you get, and heat rises, and that's the basic physics of it. But heat energy released undersea in the form of venting or a volcano, 100% of the energy is absorbed into that water, and then that can contribute significantly to heating of oceans, and very rapidly. So when you think about those kinds of disturbances along with climate change and weather modification changes that are taking place naturally, that's adding tremendous heat into this equation, whether it be in the Pacific or elsewhere. And then that's changing this whole dynamic of the way in which weather flows, and we're seeing the extremes of it literally everywhere.
Moving into one other area that's, I think, right in the middle of all this, if you look at the changes in ocean currents over the last 10 years, and even more specifically, even just the last couple of years, the current that keeps Europe relatively temperate
right.
is beginning to splinter and beginning to stall.
Right. This is a big problem. It's from the fresh water coming off of Greenland, which is actually dragging that that heat back
yes.
sooner, so it's dropping
yes.
down faster. It's not
yes.
making it to Europe.
Yes.
And so it's true. You know, when you say global warming, you can't apply that everywhere because the changes in ocean currents then, as I said earlier, with snowfall. Some glaciers are melting, others are getting thicker.
Right.
But it's the same true is true here. If you think about the citrus belt in the United States even, you know, it used to grow a lot more citrus a lot further north than we grow today, and yet the average temperatures are warming. So it's climate change is the better word than global warming, although that does apply. When you start to think of Europe changing, you know, there's, again, a major implication in terms of food production, distribution, all of those important things to modern culture.
So when you add all of this up, Doctor, it adds up to something awfully ominous. And I refuse to believe that even an administration that is not famous for its environmental sensitivity has not been privately briefed on how dire it really is. And I personally think it's very dire indeed. And so what could they do but look to people who were doing experiments and work that might head off what otherwise looks to me like something pretty big?
Well, I think, firstly, is proper modeling so we can figure out where those new agricultural areas are going to be. And I can assure you some of them are going to be in this part of the world. We have some of the best potential agriculture here. And Canada, again, you know. And so you got to look at sort of what's happening and then how weather patterns and water patterns are going to change. The other big consideration is coastal cities. I mean, over the next 50 to 60 years, this is going to be, you know, do we rebuild in places like New Orleans? And the answer is probably, and disappointingly to many, the answer is probably no. You know, it's we have to be more sensible and recognize these changes and start addressing them, because there's not enough tax dollars to do it one disaster at a time. You know, Katrina was a $300 billion disaster in climbing. And you know, we have opportunities, I think, and that's where some of the best minds in the world need to be engaged in looking at the opportunities that climate change brings as much as it brings destruction. Because at the other end of the day, the question is, the human race will survive, should survive, but you know, we need to use our heads a little bit.
So if you were the one who had made the decision with regard to rebuilding of New Orleans, if you'd been able to make that decision, you would have said,
higher ground, folks. We got to do it the right way.
Do not rebuild there.
No, it's just not good to build below sea level when you know it's only going to get worse.
Well, I think we are going to, and we are in fact, rebuilding New Orleans. The question is, how many lessons are we going to be served up before we decide not to do it?
You know, it's our stubbornness, you know, and again, it's so many people want to fight over the politicize the environmental debate, and it's not about that. It's really about what's obvious to everyone, and you know, and having a government that addresses what's obvious to everyone is what everyone sort of expects.
Hey, Dr. Bigich, we could do this, believe me, all night long, buddy, and we'll have you back when Dr. Eastland is available. That'll be shortly,
great.
I trust, right?
I hope so. I hope we can get him on soon.
Okay, my friend. Thank you for being here. A very quick hour indeed. I'll talk to you shortly.
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Take care.